presentation will be limited to approximately 45 seconds. So, with that, we will open up a work session on House Bill 2333. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2333A relates to sex offender registration in Oregon. ORS 181.595 and 181.596 require certain persons convicted of sex crimes to maintain lifetime sex offender registration in Oregon. There is presently a mechanism for relief from this requirement at ORS 181.600. House Bill 2333A revises Oregon's sex offender reporting requirements for specific crimes. Those crimes include rape 3, sodomy 3, sex abuse 3, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, sexual misconduct, or the attempt versions of any of these crimes. It applies to persons who are, one, convicted of one of those crimes or the attempted versions of one of those crimes, two, found guilty except for insanity of one of those crimes, three, who committed one of the crimes under juvenile court jurisdiction, or four, who were convicted in another state of one of the crimes or their equivalents. If any of those four conditions are met, then a person need not report as a sex offender if each one of the following is true. One, the person is less than 5 years older than the victim. Two, the victim's lack of consent was solely due to the age of the victim. Three, the victim was at least 14 years of age. And four, at the time of the offense, the person had no prior adult or juvenile convictions for any sex-related crime offenses. The Dash 5 amendments are for the committee's consideration. What the Dash 5 amendments do is they clarify the process through which a person would be relieved of this reporting obligation. So we're both talking about individuals who have been in the past convicted and are having to report as sex offenders now, or people then prospectively into the future who would be convicted of reportable crimes. The amendment addresses the processes for both of those persons. For future convictions, first of all, it requires that a court affirmatively enter an order to relieve somebody of this obligation. For future convictions, the court makes the determination whether the specific criteria that are previously articulated applies based on a preponderance of the evidence standard. For convictions from the past in which a person presently must register but wants relief, the person must file a motion for relief from the reporting requirement and an affidavit of eligibility within the circuit court in the appropriate county. So the person must make a sworn statement essentially saying, I was less than 5 years older than the victim, that lack of consent was solely due to age, the victim was at least 14, and I have no priors, etc. The district attorney then would either agree that the person meets the criteria, or if the district attorney objects, there would be a hearing set for the court to decide, again, based on a preponderance of the evidence standard. At this hearing, the rules of evidence would not apply, so hearsay would be admissible. That's the Dash 5 amendment for 2333A.
Okay, that's the guy we're working with, and we have Representative Krieger signed up here. And this is a work session, right? We're in work session. We have two other people signed up that we probably won't get to unless they're with you. The Donaldsons. And we will not be taking any testimony except from Representative Krieger, except for maybe 15 seconds worth. Sorry. Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1. How much time do I have?
45 seconds. we're going to do something with this bill in 1 minute. We'll either kill it or we'll pass it, depending on whether we're done.
If you're ready to vote, I won't say anything.
We're ready to vote.
Madam Chair.
What?
Move the Dash A5 amendments in House Bill 2333.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2333. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Chair, House Bill 2333 is amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2333 to the Senate as amended to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Member of the work group.
Anything else?
Okay, next we have House Bill.
Senator Burdick.
What?
What was the number of the bill you just gave?
The what?
The number of the bill?
2333. House Bill 2333A.
And we had thought we were here on 2553.
Are you here on that other? Okay, which one's that?
What, 2508?
There's one up on the list.
My apologies. We are moving that bill to Rules Committee, where it will get a hearing, and it will get
You're going to move that today?
We're going to move that to Rules today. My apologies for misunderstanding. Your bill will be in good hands.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Is that one over there?
Yeah.
Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 2508. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2508A relates to red light cameras. ORS 810.434 allows cities with populations over 30,000 and Newburgh to install and operate red light cameras at the city's expense. Presently, Portland, or as it's referred to in the statute as, quote, a city with a population of 300,000 or more, close quote, is limited to no more than 12 cameras. Other cities are presently limited to cameras at no more than 8 intersections. House Bill 2508A amends this statute by eliminating the threshold population requirement and the Newburgh exception, which would no longer then be necessary. It also eliminates the restriction on the numbers of intersections in which a city can install cameras. Finally, House Bill 2508A also eliminates a requirement that the Oregon Department of Transportation prepare and provide a report to the legislature on the subject each session.
Okay. We have no amendments, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Senator Pozanski, we need a motion.
Move 2508A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. That's House Bill 2508.
Senator Pozanski has moved House Bill 2508A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Flynn.
A one-time aye.
Senator Pozanski, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Vice Chair
Byer?
No.
Aye. Okay. Boy, do you want to fight me for this, or you want me to carry it?
Not me.
Your choice, Madam Chair. I'm here to serve.
Then you'll carry it.
That's what I was afraid of.
All right. Okay, now we will open a public hearing. Do we have, who's here on this?
McPherson is here. I think it's on.
2872.
McPherson.
Representative McPherson here. We will wait till he comes back.
He doesn't care about it. We can just let it.
We will open a work session on House Bill 3379. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3379A was before us, I believe, yesterday. It relates to the creation of the Class C felony of criminal possession of a rented or leased motor vehicle. In short, existing law has ORS 164.140, crime of criminal possession of rented or leased personal property. That law requires that a rentor give 10 days' notice before any sort of criminal action can occur. The point of House Bill 3379A is to shorten that 10-day requirement to 3 days in the case of a rented or leased motor vehicle. In addition, the bill makes one substantive change about the notice that's required. You can use any overnight, any commercial overnight service. There were some discussions about the state's ability to prosecute these sorts of cases as unlawful use of a vehicle under existing law 164.135, but I believe the proponents of the bill spoke with myself and with Senator Pozanski and others about the point of 3379A.
Okay, so we have no amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, Senator Byer?
I'm Chair of House Bill 3379A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 3379A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Up on the record, I am going to support the bill. I talked to the proponents and told them that I'd be comfortable moving it. I do think there's a better way of making it more streamlined. One of the ways is just using the UUV, maybe having something built into that statute that would provide a grace period instead of having the separate one, but it is what it is. It's late in the season. Here we are.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pozanski. Senator Pozanski has moved House Bill 3379A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I can carry that if you like it, unless you want to.
I'll be glad to carry it, but okay. That was Senator Byer that actually made that motion.
Senator Byer, I'm sorry. So which one am I complimenting?
Both of us.
Okay. Okay, you can carry that one. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2872A. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2872A relates to cell phones and persons under 18. As of November 2006, there are 14 states that had laws banning or restricting young drivers from using cell phones. Another four states ban or restrict cell phones for all drivers. Oregon presently does not prohibit the use of cell phones while driving. As a matter, in fact, ORS 801.038 specifically prohibits any city, county, or other local government from enacting such restrictions. House Bill 2872A prohibits a person under 18 with a provisional driver's license, a special student driver permit, or an instructional driver permit from using a mobile communication device while driving a vehicle on a highway. Mobile communication device covers phones and text messaging. It's specifically defined in the statute. There is an exception for emergencies. And in the original bill, the violation is only enforceable as a secondary action, which what that means is that the officer must have stopped a person for a different offense in order to be able to cite for this offense. And there is one amendment for the committee's consideration. It's A4 amendment. The A4 amendment removes the secondary offense provision. In other words, if the A4 amendment is adopted, an officer would be able to stop a person solely for the offense of using a cell phone while driving. A person under 18.
Okay, Representative McPherson. He went out again. Send the marshals.
He doesn't want this bill very bad.
I don't want it either.
Send the marshals after Representative McPherson.
Bill's dead.
It was my mistake.
Are we in public or work session?
We are in public hearing.
Okay.
Senator Pruzanski. We will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2872, what we do for people on the Senate Judiciary. We will open a work session on House Bill 2127. What's that? I think that's
2127?
Yeah. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2127A relates to refining the juvenile code to be consistent with the Oregon Constitution. Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Sections 42 and 43, articulates the rights of crime victims during all stages of criminal prosecutions, both adult and juvenile. Such rights generally include to be present at and timely notified of critical events, to obtain various information about a defendant's status, prompt restitution, to be consulted about plea negotiations, etc. House Bill 2127A revises the juvenile code to be consistent with these constitutional rights, and in some cases, then it provides additional clarification. The more substantive of these clarifications include: absent good cause, a victim need not reveal the victim's address or telephone number to the defendant. Two, if a defendant's agent contacts the victim, the agent must reveal the agent's identity, that the victim need not speak with the agent, and that the victim may have an agent of the state present for any conversations. Three, any pre-adjudication release of a juvenile defendant must include a no contact with the victim order. Four, the victim must be consulted regarding a juvenile defendant's entry into any sort of diversionary programs. And then five, a court may not release a juvenile awaiting adjudication if the charge involves a violent felony or if the juvenile poses a danger of serious physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or the public.
Okay, we're in work session. Senator Beyer.
House Bill 2127A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2127A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you carry this?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay. My apologies, Representative Wisnett, but better late than never. We will now open a work session on House Bill 3442.
Go ahead. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3442 modifies the definition of a police officer under the vehicle code, and there was a technical fix from legislative counsel just changing the language for the purpose of a law enforcement district and adding an emergency clause so that Senator Walker can get her ticket promptly in Sun River.
Very good, counsel. Very
I
good.
I never speed in Sun River.
Well, but What about every place else?
Better not now.
Okay, Senator Beyer, we have the -A4 amendment in front of us.
Madam Chair, I move the -A4 amendment to House Bill 3442.
Senator Beyer has moved the -A4 amendment into House Bill 3442. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3442 as amended to the floor with a DUFAP recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 3442 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wisnett.
Well, Madam Chair, I hope Representative Wisnett puts out a press release to his district so they...
so they know?
No.
So that they slow down? Okay. We will now open a work session on House Bill 3279, if we have counsel here for that. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3279 was the free speech student journalist bill that we heard yesterday. There are -A6s before the committee that were just handed to me. Do people have those? I'm not sure if...
Yep.
Yes. The main changes to the original Angrist bill are, if you look on the -A6s, line 5 and 6, violates federal or state statutes, rules or regulations, or state common law. So that would be another exception as to when they could... they're saying that nothing in this bill would allow speech that, and this would be another exception, violates federal and state statutes. And I think we heard testimony that there are certain federal licensing rules out there that require some sort of restraint on speech in certain instances. Another change is if you look at lines 18 through 22 and then going on to the back of page 2, these are exceptions that occurred in the high school context. They just copied those and put it into the college context as well. So it's the same idea that nothing in this bill except speech that would, and it includes now, so incite students as to create a clear and present danger of, and list the exceptions. And those already exist in the, as for high school students, it also exists as the college students now. They put the damages provision back into the bill, and you heard some testimony that was to stop these cases from being mooted. So this is another fix, similar to the one that this committee heard the other day. And other than that, it also deletes the part of the Angrist bill that says that you couldn't discipline a student media advisor. It takes that out of the bill also. So I'm not sure if Neil Bryant is here. I don't see him.
I don't see. Is anybody from higher ed here? Okay, we don't really need it.
What we're going to do based on it.
I was going to say, I think they had faith that we're going to move this once they got the amendments.
They've learned to have a lot of faith in Senate Judiciary. Okay. I'm having trouble locating my -6 amendments. Senator Beyer, we have a -6 amendment in front of us.
Madam Chair, I move the -6 amendments in the House Bill 3279.
Senator Beyer has moved the -6 amendment into House Bill 3279. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I'll make move House Bill 3279 as amended by the 6th to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Brzezinski has moved House Bill 3279 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Would you call the roll?
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator
Mosby? Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Burton?
Aye. I will carry this. Okay, moving right along. What should we do next? What should we do next? Let's see, I've got that on. What do you want to do next? I've lost mine. Okay. We will open a... Oh, no, wait a second. Don't we have another work session? Let's see. This one. Oh, the crime Christmas tree. Let's do that. Get Darian. We will open a work session on House Bill 2651, otherwise known as the crime Christmas tree bill.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2651A, the underlying bill relates to the existing crime of failure to disclose that conversations are being recorded. I'll explain the amendments then individually. ORS 165.540 generally makes it a Class A misdemeanor for a person to record conversations without the knowledge of all participants. There are certain exceptions to this rule, including but not limited to jail conversations and the recording of any conversation during a felony that would endanger human life. House Bill 2651A adds a new exception for a law enforcement officer if the officer is in uniform, displaying a badge, and operating a vehicle-mounted video camera that records the scene around a police vehicle for the duration of an event that began as an effort to enforce a traffic or vehicle law. Many officers have such devices in their vehicles, and they use such devices in connection with a traffic stop. Stop somebody, turn on the camera. And they will tell the officers will tell the subject of the stop that the conversation is being recorded, but it's possible during lengthy traffic stops that other persons might enter into the video camera's range and area and be recorded without the person's knowledge. So the original bill, House Bill 2651A, prevents officers from being criminally liable under the statute for such actions, not being able to tell everybody that they're being recorded. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 amendments that are relevant for consideration today. The first is the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment adds an additional exception for officers in connection with the use of tasers. We talked about that briefly. There are new tasers that are being deployed and I think even being used by some law enforcement now that automatically when the taser is activated, it's recorded. And so it's impractical in those situations to give notice, and so this adds an exception for that. That's the A3 amendment. The A5 amendment is what used to be Senate Bill 536, and that provides that any defendant with a felony Dewey conviction from Oregon or another state is ineligible for diversion in Oregon. That standalone is what the A5 does. The A7 amendment is what used to be former Senate Bill 810. And the A7 amendment provides clarification as to what out-of-state Dewey-related convictions count against a defendant in Oregon in terms of calculating prior Deweys. And if the committee will recall, that was where we had a discussion about some states. In Oregon, it has to be a public roadway or premises open to the public. That's one of the Dewey elements. Some states don't have that requirement. So technically, Washington doesn't have that requirement. There are some judges who would feel that a Washington Dewey conviction can't count in Oregon because they're not equivalent enough. And so Senate Bill 810 seeks to address that. There was some concern of Ms. Alconich with Criminal Defense Lawyers Association came and testified about some overbreadth in the proposed language. There was a sort of mini work group of sorts that got together with Ms. Alconich, John Bradley from Multnomah County DA's office, myself, Alex Somalian, criminal defense attorney, and Josh Nasby with legislative counsel. I believe the language that was agreed to was unanimously supported.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, the A8 amendment combines everything. So it's the 3, the 7, and the 5 all put together.
So okay. If we get the 8, we take care of all of them?
That's
we
right.
do. And in order to get into the crime Christmas tree bill, it had to be consensus, no opposition. So if anybody has opposition to any of these, we'll move them separately. Otherwise, we will ask Senator Byer to move the dash A8.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A8 amendments into House Bill 2651.
Senator Byer has moved the dash A8 amendment into House Bill 2651. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this.
Should we move
the bill first?
Oh, okay. Move
just
the bill.
Just the amendment.
You're just so picky. so we reopen the work session. Senator Byer.
You can leave the rest of the bill behind, but I thought it was kind of important. move House Bill 2651 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2651 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'll still carry it. Thanks. Okay. I think we can move to 2340.
We can, and then we'll just wait for Nancy to bring
it. Okay. Yeah. We're going to open a public hearing now on House Bill 2340, which is not at all the same bill that it started out with, but Council will explain all that.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2340, as the Chair explained, is sort of a gut and stuff. We're considering the dash 2 and then actually the dash 3 amendment, which is on its way here. It relates to drug prosecutions and evidentiary rules. In drug prosecutions, the state seizes the suspected drugs and then sends them to the state forensic crime lab for analysis. A forensic scientist then performs the appropriate analysis and then issues a written opinion. And generally, it's a one-page opinion, depending on the amount of drugs. And the opinion says, states what the substance is, and then, if appropriate, its weight. Until recently, and then it's a certified copy signed by the forensic scientist. Until recently, the law allowed the state to introduce a certified copy of this criminalist report at trial, rather than having to bring in the actual criminalist, unless the defense subpoenaed the criminalist prior to trial. If the defense had subpoenaed the criminalist prior to trial, the state would then have to call the criminalist as the state's witness, even though the defense had technically subpoenaed the person. The concern underlying this policy was twofold. First of all, one, there are numerous drug prosecutions throughout the state, and only a limited number of criminalists, and I believe it's maybe seven or eight criminalists around the state. So a limited number. And then secondly, generally, the defense does not really want the criminalist to appear at trial, because if the criminalist did not believe that the substance was illegal, well, then the case wouldn't be going to trial to begin with. Recently, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case known as State versus Birchfield, which was decided April 19th of 2007, the Oregon Supreme Court found that Oregon's existing scheme violated a defendant's right under the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 11, to meet witnesses face-to-face. A United States Supreme Court case called Crawford versus Washington dealt with similar issues under the United States, the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The primary problem, according to the Oregon Supreme Court, was that requiring the defendant to subpoena the criminalist was too big of a burden for the defense. The Oregon Supreme Court suggested that some sort of notice to the state in advance of trial that the defense wants the criminalist present would be more appropriate. To use the specific language of the court in their opinion, quote, the legislature may require the defendant to assert that right, and that is the right to confront the criminalist, or to design a procedure to determine whether the defendant agrees that a written report will suffice. House Bill 2340, specifically the Dash 2 and then the Dash 3 amendments, attempts to create such a system. It amends ORS 475.235 to state that a certified copy of a crime lab report is admissible and sufficient at trial unless the defense provides written notice of an objection. The defense must serve this written notice at least 15 days prior to trial on the court and then on the district attorney. No longer does the defense have to formally subpoena the criminalist. All that the defense would need to do is to provide written notice at least 15 days prior to trial, and that would trigger the need for the state to bring in the actual criminalist rather than relying just on the form itself. Again, what I'm talking about is the Dash 2 amendment. There is also a Dash 3 amendment that is being drafted by Josh Nasby right now. Oh, right here. It's here. And the Dash 3 amendment is what the committee should consider. The Dash 3 amendment does everything that I just talked about, but it adds, there is a two-year sunset provision in the bill to see how this system works.
Madam Chair, I just want to make one comment.
Yes.
I so appreciate that you referred to the criminalist as a her in your staff measure summary instead of a him. Just, you know, a nice thank you.
I think they all
appreciate gender equity.
Everyone I've ever dealt with is a woman, but thank you.
Excellent. Kudos for the staff. All right.
Usually the default gender is male.
We have signed up Mark McDonald and David Schmierbach.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County, and I run the drug unit.
Madam Chairman, my name is David Schmierbach. I'm the director of the Forensic Services Division for the state of Oregon. I'm here today in support of the Dash 2 amendments. I'm not familiar with the Dash 3, but we would have no objection to that sunset clause. The Supreme Court decision that came out on April 19th, also referred to as the Birchfield decision, significantly affected the number of subpoenas that the crime lab are getting for our drug chemists. Basically, every time a case that involves drugs is now scheduled for trial, the district attorneys are going to have to subpoena the crime lab people to come to testify. What happens is it usually goes to the day of trial, and then we sit and wait to see if we're actually needed. Because we are a distance from a lot of the courts where the labs are located, often we are en route or have just arrived at the courtroom to testify when we learn that we are no longer really needed. The effect of this bill is to allow time in advance of the trial for all of the necessary components that will be needed in trial to come into play without these kind of hardships that make the inefficiencies for the crime lab. It gets particularly spicy if you have multiple subpoenas on the same day, because then you get multiple courts, multiple district attorneys vying to see which one of the counties will get the criminalist for that day. The end result is we do about 10,000 drug cases a year. About 10% of them get subpoenas. This would result, if all came to play, about 2 FTE would be lost to responding to these courts for often no testimony at all. That concludes my very quick remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I have any.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to say that this is not a DA bill. This is.
Can you identify yourself?
Mark McDonald, again, Senior Deputy District Attorney from Multnomah County. This is not a DA bill. This is about a bill to preserve crime lab resources. And it's really not about the cases that go to trial. It's about all those cases that don't go to trial. My county law, we issued over 2,500 felony cases. Only 6% went to trial in 2006. Since the Birchfield decision, we have to presume that the defense is going to want the criminalists in every one of these trials. So we're going to be required to ask the crime lab to analyze the drugs and to subpoena trial. In the last several years, we worked very hard with the crime lab to reduce the number of drug cases that they've had to process. Through the help of the legislature and allowing presumptive tests to be used, a grand jury, preliminary hearing, and entrance in the drug court, we have really reduced the workload of the crime lab in drug cases, and they've been allowed to use those resources in much more serious person crimes cases. We're very fearful that if we do not have this notice requirement, the crime lab is going to be spending all their time working on drug cases and not more important serious cases. There is a question whether or not the defense can simply require notice in every case. That's true. This bill, they still would be able to do that. My firm belief is that most people in the criminal defense bar are professional. They're good people. And they're really not going to, the majority of them are not going to file this notice frivolously. And the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, they have to appear before a judge. And if they get the reputation of that they're going to just call the criminalists in to wait to see the white of their eyes, you know, that's going to hurt their standing before the court.
Since we're on the subject of drugs, I've been asked to inquire as to who the best deputy DA for drugs has ever been in your office.
I think Heidi Moad.
Oh, my God. That's ridiculous. God.
Very good answer.
She's right.
Are there other serious questions?
Yes, community? There is a serious question, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Schmiermack, you were complaining that you'd be on the way to trial and find out you weren't needed. Can't you charge a cancellation fee? That's what I do. If attorneys haven't figured out to call the court reporter in advance and let me know they don't need me, they get a bill in the mail because I scheduled my time for them. So can't you do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the law is clear that you can't penalize for somebody to exercise a constitutional right. The person has a constitutional right to confront the witness against them. All this bill does is, as suggested by the Supreme Court, requires the defendant to exercise that right by giving notice. I've tried to ask costs in the past, and the courts simply refused to do so.
Well, maybe you ought to come to federal court. They do it for me all the time. Thank you.
Unfortunately, Senator Walker, people don't have a constitutional right for a court reporter as much as we're trying to change that. Thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Amy Alconich. Welcome.
Amy Alconich here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition of this bill. But I'd like to start out by saying that this is a bill we would have been happy and would be happy to work on. I know it's late in the session, too late for that to happen, but this is kind of a tail end bill. It didn't come out early enough for us to participate in a work group, but I recognize that the crime lab needs all the help they can get. They have a lot of important things to work on other than drug cases, and I hate the idea of being inefficient in terms of having crime lab people coming up and down, going back and forth to different counties. But our concern is that this doesn't necessarily solve that problem. And I know Mr. McDonald referred to the fact that defense attorneys were not going to frivolously request or subpoena people from the crime lab, but most defense attorneys feel that we plan for every case to go to trial. We assume everyone is going to want to assert their constitutional right to confront the witness. And as part of the discovery request, we'll just include that information that we will be asserting our rights. It may even happen at arraignment. We would include that at the arraignment speech, that we would assert our right to confront any and all witnesses in this case, including the crime lab people. I think there must be a better way to solve this problem. Often we don't know about going to trial until the day before or the week before, and you still have the crime lab people who are waiting to find out whether or not they're coming up. We're happy to work with this in the interim and try and solve this problem in a way that would actually affect some real change. And my concern is that this simply wouldn't do it.
He can testify.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. I was concerned about the same things that Ms. Alconich was, and that's why I put the two-year sunset into this, to see how it works so that we can revisit it next session. And so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2340 and open a work session on House Bill 2340. Senator Barr, we have a -3 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to the House Bill 2340.
Senator Barr has moved the -3 amendment to Senate Bill House Bill 2340. Any discussion? Any objection?
Madam Chair, I'm just going to put on the record, I'm going to go ahead and support the adding the -3s because you have the sunset clause in there just to see where it's going and how it's going, because I know we all want to make certain that we're efficient with the time for our state employees, but at the same time we want to make sure the balancing's there with the rights of the defendant.
Appreciate that. Senator Walker?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll support the -3s, but I won't support the bill. I think this is something we could do in February. I just think there needs to be a bit more time spent on it.
Okay. Would you call? Actually, no objection to that. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2340 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2340 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator
Bonsky. Aye.
Senator Walker.
No.
Vice Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Burton.
Aye. I will carry this bill. And now I have to abjectly apologize to my good colleague, Representative Krieger, because I mixed up what bill you were here on. So now I'm going to open a bill that I was going to move to rules on House Bill. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2553. Did I get it right this time? And we've already
House Bill 2553A prohibits Department of Human Services from seeking child support from parents whose children have been removed from the home because of allegations of abuse and neglect. If the department determines after completion of child abuse, Child Protective Services assessment, the allegation of child abuse is unfounded.
And if you would, please relay my personal apologies to your... Were those constituents that you brought up?
No, Madam Chair. They were of Representative Crummell's constituents.
Okay. Well, anyway, welcome back, and you have all the time you need.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State District 1. The Dependency Work Group became aware of House Bill 2553, and of course that is Senator Brown, Senator Cruz, Representative Schaff, and myself had done the prior dependency bills that you had saw and passed out of your committee. And we decided there was, in fact, a need for 2553 after discussing the issue. And I'm going to go real briefly over some information I had because they were not my constituents, but I know a little bit about kind of what went on. Basically, there were two children taken out of a home and placed in foster care. And on a Friday, the parents had taken the children to a hospital or someplace, and the EA doctor made a diagnosis of staph infection and sent them home with antibiotics. On Monday evening, DH caseworkers and police officers arrived at their home, examining the sore, which now had become much better, decided it was a burn, and removed the children from the home. What seemed strange is the ER workers, you know, emergency room, said it was staph infection, but somehow that information got DHS, and it came out they thought it was a burn. This went on for, the children were in foster care for about 7 months, and after that time, DHS stopped fighting and agreed that the kids could come home with supervision for a while. No criminal charges were ever filed, and there was never been a conviction. The father, Derek, had lost his job as a result of missing work trying to get his children back. He, in the meantime, did find another job, making slightly less, more than half of what he'd been making before, having to drive 35 miles further than before. Then, just at Christmas, DHS started garnishing his wages to pay for the child support for the 8 months his kids had been in state care. That left them with about $600 a month to live on for a family of five, which makes it very difficult. They also got involved in attorney costs of around $30,000, and they still owe $6,000 on that. So what you really have, the potential for happening because of the policies of the time, parents and kids going through the trauma of separation and embarrassment in their community. This was, in fact, a financial disaster for anyone who gets involved in this, which for years will affect the family. Then DHS bills them for foster care when DHS took 7 months to figure out that there was no child abuse. Not exactly what I call in my mind a justice or a timely decision on for the family's benefit. House Bill 2550 will protect innocent parents and families from predatory garnishment by DHS.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming back. We will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2553A and open a work session on House Bill 2553A.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2553A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2553A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, this is your bill.
Love to, sir. Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2872 for, I think, the third time. Third time's a charm. Wait for our counsel here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, a reminder, House Bill 2872 relates to persons under 18 using cell phones while driving a vehicle. The offense would be a Class B violation. What the bill would do is it would prohibit a person under 18 with a provisional driver's license, a special student driver permit, or an instruction driver permit from using a mobile communication device while driving a vehicle on a highway. The term mobile communication device is specifically defined in the statute. There's an exception in the statute for emergency situations. And in the underlying bill, the violation, the Class B violation, is only enforceable as a secondary action, which means that the officer must have stopped the person for a different offense and then sort of tack this one on. There is an A4 amendment to the bill, and that bill removes that secondary offense provision. In other words, if you adopt the amendment, the officer would be able to stop a juvenile, a person under 18, just for the offense of using a cell phone while driving.
Okay, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Greg McPherson, State Representative for House District 38, which is Little Southwest Portland and Lake Oswego. This bill was an outgrowth of an incident that happened just a year ago today. It was that year, the 30th of May, was the day after Memorial Day, and there was a cyclist that is a relative of my wife's who was cycling from his home in Medford south, and he was out on a fine sunny day like this after work, and as he was approaching an intersection, a Jeep Cherokee came at a right angle turn across his path and hit him full force. And according to witnesses at the scene, the driver of the Jeep Cherokee didn't even touch his brakes. He just hit straight on with the cyclist, flipped him up so he hit the windshield, it cracked his helmet open. The cyclist was near death. He was in a coma for several weeks. Eventually did survive and is making remarkable progress considering, but with some long-term impairments. Now, why would the driver of the Jeep Cherokee not even touch his brakes as he's headed toward the cyclist as he's cutting this corner? Well, it was an 18-year-old who was talking on a cell phone, and cell phone records were obtained that established, according to the investigation done by the local district attorney, that the young driver was 7 minutes into a cell phone conversation with a friend. When you think about that whole scene, I think it dramatizes the need for this bill. We have young drivers who are statistically, we know, less safe drivers. That is, there's a lot of experience that one picks up over time as one drives around the roadways. One's reaction time may not be getting any better, but one's judgment about the road hazards one's encountering improves over time, and that shows up in accident statistics. And what this bill does is it prohibits the use of cell phones and text messengers by a driver who is in the provisional stage, that is a 16 or 17-year-old. It wouldn't extend quite as far as the particular driver who was 18 years old who hit this relative down in southern Oregon, but and that reflects, I think, generally kind of the tension that runs through our thinking about cell phone restriction bills in this building, but it's been scaled back to a bill that it enjoys now broad support. It passed this bill passed the floor of the House by a vote of 54-3, and so there's broad support for restricting our youngest drivers because they should be focusing on learning to drive rather than using that kind of communication technology. Now, you do have the A4 amendments. The way the bill came out of committee in the House, it makes the use of a cell phone or text messenger while driving a secondary offense. That is, you can't be stopped for doing just that alone. You have to be stopped for something else. And then when you are stopped for that, it's a Class B, as in Baker, traffic violation, which is a fairly stiff fine, $360. What the A4 amendments would do is to make two changes. One is to make it not a secondary offense. A young driver could be stopped for using a cell phone or a text messenger itself, not in connection with another violation. But then it would be a Class D violation on which the maximum fine is $90. As I thought about the version that got passed out of the House Transportation Committee, and it did get amended to have this secondary feature in it, it concluded that the incentives were wrong. It really creates an incentive for the young driver who thinks that he or she can do it all to assume that the fact that it's only a secondary violation and it's only if they have some other mishap, some other violation, that they're going to get be sanctioned for using their cell phone. It creates an incentive for that young driver to take a chance, but a chance on something that's a fairly stiff penalty if they do get caught. And I think as a general psychological matter, we find that it's the probability of punishment that tends to shape behavior rather than severity of punishment. So I think that it's better to have it be more readily applied, that is, found as a primary violation, but then subject to a lower sanction, and that's more likely to have an impact on the young driver's conduct than to have it be a secondary violation, but with a more serious penalty. So the A4 amendments, I think, are a good idea because they're more readily available to law enforcement, but it isn't such a big deal at the time that the sanction is applied. So with that, I'll pause and ask for any questions.
This isn't the world's most friendly cell phone restriction committee, Representative McPherson, as I have told you. The chair accepted. If you were not able to get the -4 amendment, would you still want the bill?
I think it's a good bill even without the -A4 amendments, but I would say for those who are uncomfortable with sort of the regulation of cell phone usage generally, I would think that scaling it down from a Class B to a Class D violation would make it more acceptable. That is, we're not imposing such a stiff sanction on the young driver who's found in violation. So I would think that there would be aspects of the amendment that should appeal even to those who are uncomfortable with cell phone regulation. And I would also just hasten to point out, even for those who are uncomfortable with the idea of regulating cell phone use or restricting cell phone use by more mature drivers, and these are 16 and 17-year-olds. These are kids who are learning to drive and who, by common observation on my part, and I think you've probably seen the same thing, they are heavy users of this technology. So we would be enhancing the safety of our roadways considerably to be passing a bill that provides a lower sanction but with greater probability of enforcement.
Okay. Questions, Senator Pazansky?
Madam Chair, I'm going to speak about the A4s. I am supportive of the A4s. I'll vote for the bill either way because I think the case has been made and documented that these young drivers are, in fact, in a position of trying to, let's say, learn the rules of the road as well as applying that in actual driving. And the last thing I feel that you need to have is them being, not observant to what they need to be learning in the skill set that's going to carry them into later life as being a good driver, knowing the rules, knowing their limitations and how to react and respond. More importantly, the way the bill is currently written, we're going to be setting up young people for two tickets. Because what's going to end up happening is that even though an officer has the right and the discretion not to cite for every violation they see, I bet you on this type of offense, they will in fact be citing them both because it's almost like a predicate that you have the first offense to result in the citing of the second offense. And even though the law says that they don't have to do it, I can guarantee you the officers are going to be covering themselves. Instead of putting on the back of the ticket, I observe them making an illegal left-hand turn. I only cite it for the cell phone use, but you're going to see them hit for both. And then as it's currently written, since it is a B, as in boy, violation, it is a $360 maximum, and they're going to have another one. So you're going to actually see young people who actually are going to be they already have the state watching how they learn to drive, and if they get too many citations in a short period of time, they're going to find themselves in a position of not being able to drive legally because they're going to be suspended. So I think the A4 actually accomplishes what most of us would want if you support having some limitation of a use of cell phones while driving. This would be the class of people you'd want to hit, and you also don't want to make sure that they're not, let's say, getting twice the number of tickets.
Thank you. Did you have any comment on that?
No, other than here, no.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We have Troy Costellas, if you're still here, Troy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costellas, manager of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I will not repeat anything that Mr. Stanford or Representative McPherson pointed out or Senator Pazansky pointed out. Other than attached to my testimony is a repeat from a study that you received earlier when you had cell phone testimony day in this committee, which is the National Transportation Safety Board hearing and their finding that they agree with this type of restriction for the newer drivers, very similar to the testimony already given. And that's the only unique piece that I can add, is that there's a national group that studied this and has recommended this restriction for the new drivers as well. Okay. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be more happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And you would agree that it'd be better to extend it to everyone?
Madam Chair, it would make a difference. I think it would be an interesting enforcement and court conversations if it was for everybody in all the circumstances.
Okay, thank you. Very diplomatically handled. okay, any questions for Mr. Costellas? Thank you. Andrea and Amy, you all want to come up or not?
She doesn't even need her computer this time.
Did you lose your computer?
It's not working for some reason without the plug. I must have burned it out or something.
Yeah.
Amy Elkanich on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we have not objected to this bill at any point with the exception of the A4 amendments today. My concern is that age is a subjective... Did I say Amy Elkanich with CDLA?
Yes, track. You did.
Is that age is a subjective determination. I'm concerned that it will be a good excuse for profiling or pretext stops if you make it a primary, ticket. So we would hope that you would move the bill without it. We absolutely think it's unsafe for kids to be driving with cell phones. I'm just concerned about how it will be applied and the fact that it relies on the police making a very, very subjective determination. I frankly can't tell the difference between a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old sometimes.
Well, Ms. Elkanich, I'm 51 and I don't look it, do I? I could pass for a 17-year-old. I mean, I was thinking the same thing. It's pretty funny, but I understand. But, Madam Chair, we have this provisional license thing here in Oregon, and so already young people are being profiled and being stopped to ask, you know, you did something illegal back there, or do you have a driver's license? Do you have a provisional? How come do you have these extra people in the car? Have you done your 6 months of driving with other people? So, I mean, we already do that to some extent to these young people.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I think that's true, and I wasn't around for the provisional license issue. I don't even know when that happened. But I do know that I would...
It happened in 99 when I was a freshman.
So I wasn't here and didn't have the opportunity. I just hate to add one more thing to the list that police officers can stop young people for. And Amy Miller's here from Juvenile Rights Project, although she's not up here, and she supports the general... just of the bill, but also has some concerns about the A4 amendments.
Okay. Andrea?
Yeah, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I, too, have done my hardest to stay out of all these bills this session and successfully done it. We share OCDLA's concerns and urge you, if you're going to move the bill forward, to do it without the dash A4s.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Pruszynski.
Amy, probably more for you and your background as a criminal defense lawyer. I mean, officers have a reason to stop. In this case, they believe the person that's driving the vehicle is underage and they're operating or using a cell phone. They ask for license and insurance registration. When they get that license and it says provisional license on it, then they know they got a good stop. If it doesn't, wouldn't you agree that they, at that point, if that's the only reason they stopped them, would have to terminate their inquiry and turn around and walk back, just as if it was a case where you had driver's license plates up in the window, they couldn't see the expiration date, but as soon as they saw it, they would say, have a good day, turn around and walk back.
Yes, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, I think that that is three-quarters of the way, and from the defense perspective, accurate. My concern is you have an officer who then starts engaging in conversation with the individual, what they're absolutely allowed to do, or does a visual search of the vehicle, and perhaps this is somebody in a community that they know or that they have a lot of police contact with, and they use that as the pretext for stopping and getting a look in the car, seeing if they're associating with a known gang member. I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons to stop somebody, and this just gives one more way to get at that vehicle, that individual, although I know the provisional license issue is a valid one. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We don't have anybody else signed up for this, but I've lost my sign-up sheet, so I don't know for sure. So.
Well, that's one way to call an invitee hearing.
I have so much stuff up here. If anybody else would like to talk, now's the time. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2872A and open a work session on House Bill 2872A. And I will ask Senator Walker for a motion.
Oh, joy. I'll move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2872.
Senator Walker has moved the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2872. Is there any discussion?
Well, only, Madam Chair, I think the moving the fine lower, the infraction lower, but it comes at a cost, apparently, because now it's going to be the primary reason for stopping someone. But if an officer has that much time to be stopping young people they see on a cell phone, then that must be because you've added more photo red lights to these cities. So there you go. I understand that these young people should be focusing on driving, and they're already being stopped to check to see if they have a provisional, which is the bill we passed in 1999. I think I actually voted against that because we had young people testifying that they couldn't get to school if they lived out in the rural communities. But be that as it may, it's a better bill. So,
okay. Any objection to the A4 amendments? So ordered. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I'll move House Bill 2872 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has dutifully moved House Bill 2872 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Byer.
Yeah, I'll call the roll, I guess, just to comfort all of you. You know George Bush has listened to the calls anyway.
That's what the black box is there for, right?
You finally admitted it, Senator Byer.
Thank you.
Call the roll.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
No.
Chair Byer?
Aye.
He's got a camera in your bedroom, too.
Senator Pruzanski, would you like to carry this?
Sure, I'll carry it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, now, could you call Representative Galizio? We'll do him next. We're just kind of blowing our way through here.
School bill's been done.
Because you snapped a bunch of them off to rules.
Okay. All right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2252. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this bill was before this committee on a number of occasions. In fact, it passed out once. I believe Senator Walker was going to be the carrier, and then the persons with the Department of Consumer and Business Services asked that it be re-referred back to the committee for primarily a word change, changing the person to individual, I believe. But in any event, 2252A, generally under existing law, Oregon law allows state agencies to request the Oregon State Police to run criminal background checks, state or national, on various categories of persons. The agency can only require persons to provide fingerprints in connection with such background checks if there is a specific statutory authorization for such a requirement. Fingerprints are significant because with fingerprints you can get a much more comprehensive nationwide background check. 2252A provides specific authorization for such a background check for certain specific agencies. Of these agencies, only the real estate commissioner presently has this authority. It expands the classes of persons that various agencies can get background checks on. The agencies that are authorized under the bill include the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS, the Oregon Commission for the Blind, Oregon Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, Oregon Board of Radiologic Technology, Oregon Board of Accountancy, and the Housing Community Services Department. There is a Dash 5 amendment that is relevant for the committee's consideration today. The Dash 5 amendment addresses the concern that caused the bill to be pulled from the floor originally. It clarifies language about who the real estate commissioner can run searches on, and it adds the Oregon Board of Accountancy to the list of agencies that may do background checks on employees.
Okay, do we have anybody from DCBS here on this? Why don't you come on up, and if anybody has any questions, identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Salvador Llerenas. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer for DCBS.
Okay, and you've looked at the amendments, and they pass muster as far as you're concerned?
Yes, they do, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Dash five.
Okay, we are in work session. Senator Beyer,
Madam
with the
Chairman,
dash five amendment.
Dash five, A5 amendments to House Bill 2252.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2252. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2252 as amended to the floor and do pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2252A as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, you haven't carried one for a while. Would you like to carry this?
Oh, sure.
What a sport. Yeah. Okay. Now, let's do adverse possession.
Okay.
We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2676. No, we're not. We're going to close this public hearing, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2568. Council.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2568A is the event data recorder bill. It establishes that the data on a motor vehicle event data recorder is the exclusive property of the owner of the motor vehicle. It may not be retrieved or used by any person without the owner's written consent. The bill prohibits insurers from requiring owners to disclose data as a condition of settlement of a claim or of providing insurance. It allows a court to require the disclosure of data in certain instances and permits retrieval without consent of the owner for medical purposes or to repair a motor vehicle. There is one amendment before the committee, the dash 8-4s, and it concerns the insurance provisions of the bill. And what it does is if you go to line page 2 of the engrossed bill, it deletes the sentence that begins with this subsection does not prevent an insurer from offering reduced premiums for a policy based on a consensual agreement with the insured, allowing the insurer to retrieve or use data on a motor vehicle event data recorder. The amendments would delete that sentence, and I believe these are consensus amendments.
A4.
The A4s. Correct.
Okay, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my senator. It was an excellent description. Originally the idea
was... You have to give your name.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Larry Galizio, House District 35. Apologize. I didn't know about these event data recorders until I read an article. And they're compared sometimes to the black box that we have in an airplane. And one comedian actually said, why don't they make the entire airplane out of the black box material? But anyway, that's a different issue. But calling it a black box is probably very simplistic, but they can these EDRs, these event data recorders, can record about 16 different parameters: the speed of the vehicle, turn signal, whether the turn signals were in use, et cetera, et cetera. And when an accident occurs, they preserve sort of the 5 to 20 seconds before the crash. And the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration estimates about 64% of 2005 car and truck models have these event data recorders. But few consumers really know that they're being, in a sense, surveilled as they drive. And that might sound paranoid, but for me, it was one of these issues that just as if you walk into a convenience store and you're being recorded, there should be some kind of disclosure, and you should know that. So we did some research, and it turns out the federal government had some rulemaking authority that preempts or disallows any states from making disclosure law.
Mm.
So we took that out of the bill. And the disclosure, we were just going to say that car dealers should let people know that, oh, by the way, the car that you're purchasing has this event data recorder, which will record the speed at which you're driving, et cetera. So the bill's been pared down, but still I think it's useful in the sense that, number one, is it will perhaps alert people that these exist. And most importantly, it says, as was described, that this information about your driving habits, so to speak, is yours, and you own that. You own that information, and absent your consent to transfer that information, again, you are the owner of that information about your driving habits. Now, there are insurance companies that are actually offering consumers the option of installing something in their car where they can, for 6 months, record their data, transfer it down to their computer, and then send it to the company, and the company will give them a discount. I would choose not to do that, but some people might. At least in those cases, you know, because you're voluntarily saying, I would like that to happen. But anyway, so this bill just says that you own that data. So if an insurance company says they want it, or anyway, it's your data, and you own it. And it's, of course, it gives exceptions for when that data can be requested. So, and the
okay, thanks.
The amendment that you mentioned was a consensus amendment.
Terrible thing. Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Yeah,
I have to go. I have a bill up in committee. Representative Colizio, how do I know if I have one of these things in my car?
You might be able to invest, you know, go on the internet, or I tried calling a bunch of dealers, and most of them had no idea what I was even talking about. But if you go on the internet, you might be able to type in event data recorder, which cars have it, something like that. And that's another reason for the bill. I'm hoping maybe it'll get some publicity and people will even become aware of these in the first place. But
I think we're all getting chips implanted in our necks when we're born, too.
I thought when I smashed my OnStar, I was safe. But now I got to worry about this. Okay, any other questions, Senator Barr? Dave Barrows has signed up. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I'm representing Progressive Auto Insurance today. We are the author of the A4 amendment. Our system is different. The device that Representative Galizia was talking about initially is a factory-installed device, and that's the one that people don't know anything about. Our device is simply something very different. If you're a customer of Progressive or want to be a customer of Progressive, you will be offered an opportunity to put a device in your car that actually has a port in your steering column, and you voluntarily attach it. And you get a 5% discount on your insurance rate just for doing that. 6 months later, as Representative Galizio very eloquently pointed out, you can remove it, put it in your computer, download it, and send it to the company, and the company will look at it and say, wow, you're a great driver. We're going to give you 17% more. Or you're not such a great driver. We're going to give you 4% more discount. But it's a voluntary program. The language that was drafted by legislative counsel that we're asking to have deleted is confusing. Kind of, nobody knows quite how it works in our program. It has nothing to do with the original bill. Representative Galizio was good enough to give me a note to have that sentence taken out. He has indicated that's fine with him. So we would ask that you adopt the -4 amendment if you are going to move the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And what about if I were to turn in the black box to Progressive, what would happen to my rates?
Madam Chair, under the current program that Progressive is running, you would still receive the 5% for volunteering to give it a try. My guess is, from your comments both yesterday and today, is that you would probably not receive any additional reduction in your rate.
And you did have to put that on the record, didn't you? Thank you. Any questions, Senator Barr?
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer.
Chair Burdick,
member of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon. Representative Galluzzo came up with a great bill, and I then worked with him and encouraged this committee to pass it. It's too bad we can't go further, but it's a good start, and we hope it comes out of both sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2568, and is Senator Prusansky still out there? Roger, are you okay with this?
I think so.
Senator Beyer, we have the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2568.
You're going to open a work session?
I'm open a work session. I thought I did that.
Madam Chair, move the House, A4 amendments to the House Bill 2568.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2568. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2568 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2568 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. I'll carry this. Congratulations. Okay, now, the long-suffering Jim Green.
First off, the blondes. He was first off the last one. He just said, first.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2676.
Council. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wait. Yeah. Council do it first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, ORS 105.620 permits a person to acquire property by adverse possession if the person maintained actual, open, notorious, exclusive, hostile, and continuous possession of the property for a period of 10 years, and the person honestly and reasonably believed that he or she was the rightful owner of the property. What HB 2676A would do is establish that the property rights of certain public educational institutions cannot be extinguished or diminished by adverse possession. The bill applies to educational service districts, school districts, certain public schools for the deaf and blind, the Oregon University System, Oregon's public community colleges, and OHSU.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Member of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association and the Troy School District as well.
for the record.
House Bill 2676 comes for me from the North Clackamas School District. They had an issue where they had to settle a case. Even though common law practice is that you aren't able to get adverse possession title to property against municipal corporations, what this bill would do would list those entities that council has just described to you and put them into statute. Cities and counties are also municipal corporations, and they have this similar statutory protection. School districts, education service districts, and those educational entities don't. We just want to make it clear in statute that you, in fact, cannot get title against school district and other public university and public educational institutions' property through the action of adverse possession. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and we don't have any amendments to this, is that correct?
Madam Chair, no. And just for your record also, this bill came out of the House unanimous. I believe it was 55-0.
I think the question I had with this is whether it's necessary, whether it's already taken care of in the statutes.
And Madam Chair, that's a good question. If you take a look at the letter that I handed you from the North Clackamas School District, their legal counsel believes that it probably is because of the issue of common law, but that because the issue that they had to settle that case with the landowner just to go ahead and get their bus lane put in, and it would be more clear to put it into statute, similar as cities and counties have it. If you take a look about halfway down, the common law rule for cities and towns has been codified in ORS Chapter 221 and in ORS Chapter 275 for counties. All we're asking is that the same codification apply to these public education institutions.
You convinced me of the error of your ways. Okay, thank you. Question, Senator Barr? Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2676. And is Senator Prusansky still out there? If you want your bill, you have to drag up Senator Prusansky. Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 2676.
Senator Beyer. Move House Bill 2676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2676 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Either of you want to carry it?
I'll take it.
Senator Pazansky has it. Okay, we are just moving right along here. Bill, can you do 2181?
2181, yeah.
That was when we were going to do.
Yeah, this is here.
Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2181.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2181 comes at the request of Governor Kulongowski for the Department of Human. DHS requires a public or private agency having guardianship or legal custody of a child pursuant to a court order to file with the court a report when the child has been placed for a period of 6 consecutive months in the physical custody of a parent or other person. Requires the Department of DHS to include in the report a recommendation timetable for dismissal of the department's legal custody and a description of the services the department will provide to the ward to eliminate the need for the department to continue legal custody.
Okay, I lost my sign-up sheet, so did somebody sign up? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. And Legislative Council already gave you a brief rundown of the bill itself. This is a bill that came forward as a result of a National Resource Center review by the request of the Governor's Office for our Child Protective Service System last year or 2 years ago. And this bill comes forward to talk about the legal custody of in-home supervision of children, specifically after the legal jurisdiction of a child is taken into foster care and the child returns home, the legal custody continues with that child for a specific period of time that is not designated in statute at this point. So we're requesting that we put provisions in the law to allow us to get in court reports, courts to make findings on a periodic basis as to why the child needs to continue our legal custody. I provided you a written testimony, and so I'll skip over most of it. But to just share with you that we worked this bill pretty hard on the House side with members of the Human Service and Women's Wellness Committee and some community advocates, Juvenile Rights Project and others, actually reviewed the bill and have actually worked with us towards getting to one we can actually all agree and support at this point in time. I'd be happy to answer any more questions you might have.
Okay. Do you have questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else signed up to testify? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2181 and open a work session on House Bill 2181. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2181A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2181A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
How about Cruz?
Cruz would be better.
Well, I think he would be too. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
We're carrying his load right now.
Okay, well, let the record show that my committee overruled me on this. All right.
Share the wealth.
The what?
We're sharing the wealth.
We're sharing the wealth. Okay, related bill, this one. Should we do that one?
21-7, not the Mad Hatters. That's the last one. No, 21-7,
that's the last one. Is that okay? Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2179. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2179A relates to the Oregon Department of Human Services and criminal record checks. ORS 181.557 provides the mechanism for a designated agency to obtain criminal background information from the Oregon State Police regarding individuals seeking agency employment or licensing or for some other permissible agency purpose. In short, present rules require that the requesting agency either, one, provide prior written consent from the individual for such a criminal background check, or two, provide proof that the agency gave written notice to the individual that the agency might request such a background check. There are no exceptions presently to these requirements of an individual getting notice before such a background check being conducted. House Bill 2179A amends ORS 181.557 by providing for such an exception for one agency. It allows the Department of Human Services to obtain criminal background information regarding an individual without prior written consent or notice if that individual is the subject of a child abuse or neglect complaint or if the individual resides at or frequents the residence of an alleged child abuse victim. We heard testimony on that issue in the House Judiciary, and the whole idea of an individual residing at or frequenting a residence relates to the fact that DHS oftentimes gets reports about child abuse, not with a specific subject, but rather than it happening at a particular house. And so that's the idea behind the individual residing at or frequenting the residence. It allows DHS to do criminal background checks on those persons associated with the residence, where a specific person wasn't identified in the complaint. There was an amendment that was done. There's no amendment for consideration here, but the A-engrossed version does require DHS to notify the subject of a criminal record check after the fact, if there's ever one done.
Okay, we have Carrie Gilmore signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Harry Gilmore. I'm manager of the Technical Assistance Unit at the Children, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of the A-engrossed version of House Bill 2179. And my testimony is summarized in the written comments that I provided, but I just want to clarify a couple of points. The first one being that the only thing that this bill will do is it will modify the statute in such a way that it allows us to run the check prior to giving the written notice. As far as the range of people that we have authority to run checks on and the circumstances under which we can run those checks, those are already established in statute and they're not affected by this bill. In other words, we already have the authority to run checks on individuals who are not necessarily identified in a report of child abuse, but who reside in or frequent the location where the abuse is alleged to have occurred. That authority already exists in statute, and this bill does not change that. The bill does give us the authority to run the check prior to giving written notice to the individual. Under this bill, we will still provide that written notice to the individual, but we have the option to provide it after the check has been run. And what that does is it gives us the ability to run the check at the point that we receive a report of child abuse or neglect. And having that information at the point that we receive a report allows us to make good decisions into how we're going to respond as an agency to the report, what precautions we need to take, and to better assess the safety concerns that are present at that time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have on the bill.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2179A and open a work session on House Bill 2179A. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2179A to the floor to be passed recommendations.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2179A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Do you think Senator Cruz would like to carry this one,
Absolutely.
Too?
Absolutely.
Okay.
He's on a roll.
He's on a roll. I hope he favors the bill. That's all I hope. Okay. I think we're done. Okay. Now our next matter, there's a couple of bills left in here that we will not be able to take up. They have issues outstanding for one reason or another. So, Senator Beyer, I would like a motion to move these bills to the Rules Committee.
You sure?
Yes.
Positive. Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 24117, 2637, and 3086 to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Beyer has moved the aforementioned bills, has moved that the aforementioned bills be moved to the Rules Committee. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'd like everybody to take a quick look at the agenda and make sure that there isn't anything.
2150 is the only thing I had left. Maybe we got it.
2150. 2150 is going to be left hanging on the vine.
Okay.
So is there anything else that we have neglected? Because this is our very last meeting. All the friendly faces out there. committee. It has been great. It has gone very fast, and it's been a good session. We've passed mostly good bills out of here.
Notable exceptions.
Some notable exceptions. We are adjourned.
Oh, wait a second. Oh, it's not too late.